Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for November 2016. Clinical topics include navigating policies on perinatal substance abuse and estimating the relapse risk in patients with remitted depression. Two studies examined right unilateral ultra-brief pulse ECT combined with medication in geriatric depression. One study included acutely ill patients, and the other one examined combined treatment following remission. Suicide risk was the focus of another study, which calculated it prospectively in a population cohort. And a review article applies a new approach to fear and anxiety, one that takes into account both behavioral responses and conscious feeling states. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the highlights with our clinical case conference about policies on perinatal substance abuse. Samuel House and colleagues advise practitioners to be aware of their district's legal requirements. Different jurisdictions have adopted a variety of approaches. 18 states consider drug abuse during pregnancy to be child abuse. It's usually only deemed abuse when the substance is detected during pregnancy or at birth and when there's a risk to the child's health. Tennessee law holds that substance abuse during pregnancy is assault if the child is born addicted to or harmed by drug use. Three states, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, consider substance abuse during pregnancy grounds for civil commitment, which can include inpatient drug treatment. 15 states require reporting of mothers suspected of substance abuse, and 4 states require testing of mothers suspected of substance abuse. The interface of legal and clinical issues for this population has led many medical societies to publish position statements. Common themes focus on non-criminalization and enhanced access to care. The variety of factors in perinatal substance abuse complicates the practitioner's situation. The physician's role in patient care may be combined with concerns about liability for not reporting cases of perinatal substance abuse. And it may be important to know whether prenatal exposure to alcohol and tobacco qualifies as substance abuse and whether the law differs for teen pregnancies. Clinicians unfamiliar with these legalities should consult with the risk management or legal departments of their institutions. If practitioners lack access to such services, many legal codes are available online. Physicians can also contact professional societies for advice or contact private legal counsel if necessary. When substance abuse is involved, decisions must also be made about reporting to Departments of Human Services or Child Protective Services. Reporting to Child Protective Services can be damaging to a therapeutic relationship. However, involvement isn't always negative. It has the potential to be used in guiding behavior and expanding treatment options. Next, we'll look at a new framework for understanding fear and anxiety. Joseph Ledoux and Daniel Pine point out that recent research on threat processing hasn't led to significant improvements in treatments for fear and anxiety. They propose a two-systems model in which different neural circuits underlie responses to threats. One set of circuits generates conscious feelings, and a second set controls behavioral and physiological responses. The first system primarily involves cortical areas, and the second mostly involves subcortical regions, such as the amygdala. The authors believe that the amygdala itself isn't responsible for the experience of fear. Its job can be more appropriately viewed as detecting and responding to present or imminent threats. Subjective feelings of fear or anxiety aren't products of subcortical circuits underlying defensive responses. Instead, they depend on the same circuits that underlie any other form of conscious experience, namely circuits in the so-called higher-order association cortex, which are responsible for cognitive processes such as attention and working memory. The failure to recognize the involvement of two neural systems in fear and anxiety disorders has hindered attempts to develop more effective treatments. For instance, if feelings of fear or anxiety aren't products of circuits that control defensive behavior, then studies of defensive behavior in animals will have limited value in finding medications that can relieve feelings of fear and anxiety in people. The authors describe how their proposal could improve treatment outcomes. One is through differential targeting of one neural system while observing changes in the other. Some novel treatments may focus specifically on circuits that operate non-consciously, using procedures such as subliminal exposures or manipulations of attention. Alternatively, treatments might focus initially on circuits that are more closely related to conscious feeling states. Reconceptualizing fear and anxiety could also help tailor treatments to specific patients. Forms of psychotherapy that emphasize consciously deployed strategies to regulate emotions may not be ideal for patients who exhibit hyperactivity in the subcortical circuitry. But reappraisal and similar top-down strategies might be appropriate for anxious patients with standard activity in subcortical circuitry, but altered activity in cortical circuitry underlying working memory. Next, we'll look at a new method for calculating suicide prevalence. A person's history of suicide attempts is considered to predict completed suicide, but previous estimates have limited generalizability. Earlier studies used convenient samples or specific treatment settings, or they overlooked deaths from first attempts. Michael Bostwick and colleagues eliminated these biases by prospectively studying a population-based cohort. The study was based on residents of one Minnesota county. The study spanned nearly three decades, and it identified residents who made a first lifetime suicide attempt that received medical attention. These were considered index attempts. In addition, the National Death Index was used to identify all completed suicides during the study period. Over this time, suicides accounted for about 5% of all deaths. More than half of the suicides occurred in the index attempt. This rate is nearly 60% higher than previously reported. The discrepancy is explained by the inclusion of deaths from the index attempts. The ratio of male to female deaths by suicide was more than 5 to 1. However, among the index attempters, females were more numerous than males. The demographic group at highest risk for completing suicide was men aged 65 or older, but more than half of the index attempts were made by people under 25. Of those who died in their initial attempt, more than 70% used guns. Males were more likely than females to use firearms, but females who used guns were just as likely as men to die in an index suicide attempt. Regardless of sex, those using firearms had 140 times the risk of dying in an index suicide attempt as those using other methods. The study also found one protective factor. Having a follow-up psychiatric appointment scheduled at discharge significantly reduced the risk of dying in a subsequent suicide attempt. This was true whether or not the appointment was actually kept. Now we'll look at the risk of relapse in patients whose depression has remitted. It's been reported that among patients who received full remission from a major depressive episode, the rate of relapse was 16% over the next 6 months and 26% over a year. To help identify patients at greatest risk of relapse, a clinical tool is needed. Lewis Judd and colleagues developed such a tool based on the items in the Hopkins Symptom Checklist 90. The participants were patients with major depressive disorder who'd had at least 8 weeks of full remission. Raters tracked psychiatric disorders by interviewing the patients twice a year for the first 5 years and then once a year. At the same evaluations, the patients completed the Hopkins checklist. From the follow-up data, it was determined which symptoms showed increases in the 6 months preceding each relapse. The most common symptoms were anxiety, depression, anger or irritability, sleep disturbance, body aches, and heightened interpersonal sensitivity. Several specific symptoms differentiated relapse from non-relapse. However, simply counting the number of symptoms reported as moderately severe or worse during the past week created a score that was highly related to the risk of relapse. Patients with at least 10 symptoms had a 73% risk of relapse. For these patients, more frequent follow-up contacts would be warranted to intervene at the first sign of symptom worsening. Treatment of geriatric depression is our next topic. A substantial proportion of elderly patients with severe depression respond poorly to standard antidepressant treatments or can't tolerate them. For such patients, electroconvulsive therapy is an important option. Charles Kellner and colleagues report 2 studies of right unilateral ultra-brief pulse ECT in geriatric depression. In the first study, ECT was combined with venlafaxine for treating acute depression. Venlafaxine was included to enhance the acute antidepressant effect of ECT and to ensure that remitters in the acute phase would enter the next phase already having some protection against relapse. The patients in the acute phase had a mean age of 70 years and had a diagnosis of unipolar major depressive episode. They received ECT 3 times a week with standard right unilateral electrode placement. Pulse width was 0.3 milliseconds. The treatment course had no fixed time period. Patients could be declared remitters with as few as 2 treatments. Non-remitters were required to have at least 12 treatments to be considered study completers. Open-label venlafaxine was started during the first week of treatment. The target dose was 225 milligrams a day. 62% of the patients met the criteria for remission. The mean number of ECT treatments to remission was 7. Remission was significantly more likely for patients 70 and older, for those without suicidal ideation, and for those with early declines in Hamilton Depression score. Global cognitive function remained relatively stable. There was no significant difference between baseline and post-treatment mean scores on the mini mental state examination. Serious adverse events occurred in 5% of the patient. The ones that were probably or possibly related to ECT were confusion or disorientation, tardive seizure, atrial fibrillation, and urinary retention. Serious adverse events that were probably or possibly related to venlafaxine were syncope and hyponatremia. The second phase of the study compared 2 maintenance treatments. Charles Kellner and colleagues report the outcomes for medication only compared with medication plus continuation ECT. the patients were those who had remitted after receiving ECT in the acute phase. In the maintenance phase, they all received venlafaxine plus lithium over 24 weeks. The target venlafaxine dosage was 225 milligrams a day. Only moderate lithium dosages were used below the therapeutic levels used for bipolar disorder. Half the patients were randomly assigned to also receive continuation treatment with right unilateral ultra-brief pulse ECT. These patients received four more ECT treatments over 1 month, plus additional ECT as needed. At 24 weeks, the group that received ECT plus medication had significantly lower scores on the Hamilton Depression Scale than the group that received medication only. Also, significantly more patients in the ECT plus medication group were rated not ill at all on the Clinical Global Impression Severity Scale. There were no statistically significant differences between groups in scores on the mini mental state examination. No serious adverse events were attributable to ECT. This concludes our audio highlights of the November issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include addictive combat attachment behaviors in military service members, postpartum psychosis, pain as a predictor of opioid use disorder, work productivity in relation to depression outcome, neural responses to rewards in depression, and adjustment disorder after trauma exposure. We hope you'll join us. Thank you ever so much for listening.